Chapter 8. A New Life. In early January 1961, my mother and I arrived in Rabaul, a bustling port township, located at the eastern tip of the Gazelle Peninsula, on the banana-shaped island of New Britain. We were still in a spin, having just spent an idyllic, never-to-be-forgotten tropical Christmas with my brother on Karkar Island, off Midang. But, first things first. As we planned to stay, my mother rented a small, sparsely furnished, two-bedroom flat, above a retail complex on Mango Avenue, the town's main street. We arrived in Rabaul, with our suitcases filled to overflowing with tropical holiday clothes, but not a single garment suitable for the start of my first year of high school. To address the problem, my mother hastily constructed a simple sleeveless blue and white check gingham frock, with a full skirt and a bias-cut sash. This garment gave me something to wear for the first week at a new school, and allowed time for us to source the various items needed to meet the Rabaul High School's dress code. The school uniform comprised a knee-length, navy blue pleated skirt, a white short-sleeved shirt, white socks and black shoes. By the beginning of my second week I was fully kitted out, thanks to my mother's super sewing skills. The next purchase was a 24-inch Malvern Star girls' bicycle. It was bright blue and came with white wool tires, a parcel rack at the back, a wire basket hanging off the handlebars in front, a pump, but no gears. Thankfully, the streets of the Rabaul township were mostly flat. With my shiny new bicycle, of which I was extremely proud, I was able to pedal to and from school, and anywhere else I wanted to go, as we didn't yet have a car. My mother had her heart set on being a lady of leisure, thanks to my father's sizable monthly maintenance payment, that was the result of their acrimonious divorce. Very quickly, she was invited to join the local morning tea set made up of other ladies of leisure, who were married to the important businessmen of Rabaul. However, before long, the novelty wore off, and she decided it wasn't her cup of tea. She managed to politely extricate herself, after receiving a job offer from the Department of Malaria Control, who were in need of a typist. Thus began our nearly four-year association with Rabaul. One of the perks that came with working for any branch of the New Guinea administration at that time was housing. So it wasn't long before we moved out of the flat on Mango Avenue and into a three-bedroom house. Fortunately for us, the accommodation outlasted my mother's typing job, because she was soon headhunted by another department. This time, it was the Department of Education that came knocking. Word had spread that my mother was art school trained and had years of teaching experience. She accepted their offer and became the traveling art teacher for a scattering of out-of-town government schools located on the Gazelle Peninsula. We hardly noticed as we gently slid into the unhurried routine of life in tropical Rabaul. A life that was in marked contrast to the one we had left behind in Australia. I made friends with my classmates, and quite quickly, Serena McLean became my bestie. She was the second eldest of four, two of whom attended the high school, whilst her younger sisters attended Court Street Primary School. Serena's parents were pre-war Territorians, who were highly regarded by newcomers like us, caught up in the mystique of New Guinea's past. The McLeans lived in a sprawling house, on a large block of land, not far from our house. However, their lifestyle differed greatly from ours. In their household, pre-war domestic staffing levels prevailed. Their staff included a cook, a houseboy to keep their house clean, and a laundry boy to wash and iron for all six family members, as well as maintaining their shady, overgrown garden. As my much older brother had left home when I was 5 years old, I was effectively an only child. As a result, I had little first-hand knowledge of how siblings interacted. However, my association with the McLean family changed that, because I often spent time with them after school, rather than going home to an empty house, to await my mother's return from a day's teaching out of town. One afternoon, Serena's older brother, Maxwell, taught me to shoot his pellet gun. For target practice, we took turns to hit empty tin cans, lined up on the fence. Some weeks later, he taught me to shoot his .22 rifle. Some months into my first year at Rabaul High School, I took up with Jock Christian. He was a year older, and a year ahead of me. His family came from Scotland, and he was my very first boyfriend. We often attended innocent teenage parties, organized by our parents for a gaggle of up to 15 teenagers. Each family took turns to host these Saturday gatherings, that started in the early evening, and ran for 3 or so hours. Inside we danced, drank non-alcoholic punch, played pass the parcel and spin the bottle. Outside in the cool semi-darkness, we played innocent kissing games, that involved a lot of running around and hiding, to avoid those you didn't want to kiss. Another Saturday night activity was going to the movies, at Rabaul's indoor picture theatre. As Jock and I were an item, we would select a row of seats, and position ourselves in the middle of the central block. The boys would then fan out to sit on Jock's side and the girls on mine. I remember Jock and I, coyly holding hands, for the duration of the movie. Another more physical weekend activity I well remember, was an adventurous expedition a group of us planned, to climb Mount Tavorvor, the active volcano, that was perched on the rim of the caldera, encircling Simpson Harbour. The volcano would often remind us of its presence, when the westerly breeze carried the invisible waves of hydrogen sulfide gas, across the town. The gas smelt like rotten eggs, and a whiff, always caught you by surprise. The adventure began very early one Saturday morning, when we were driven from town to Matupit village. Next, a villager, in his outrigger canoe, paddled us across to the base of the volcano. Once out of the canoe, we began to climb up the side of the volcano. Even though we'd had started early, the temperature was rising. It was very warm and the climb was steep and difficult, particularly clambering across patches of loose basalt scree that were devoid of vegetation. We were all very hot and bothered by the time we reached the rim of the volcano, but our discomfort quickly faded, as we took in the breathtaking view across Simpson Harbour. We then discovered that the view down into the crater was equally breathtaking. It was like nothing I'd ever seen before or since. The internal curve of the crater was lined with grey-brown rock and patches of white fumaroles that belched rotten egg gas. On the crater floor there were areas of mid-grey mud, gently bubbling, bloop, bloop, bloop. Next, my attention was caught by a small cave of bright yellow sulfur crystals at the center of the crater floor. This crystal cave, surrounded by shades of grey, is my enduring visual memory of the excursion. Thankfully, our return trip was quicker and easier. We slid down to the base of the volcano, where the canoe was waiting to take us back across the bay, to Matupit village, and then home. When I got home, I had lots of stories to tell, and I've been telling them ever since. But I digress. Before long, my mother purchased an old and battered short wheelbase Land Rover with no synchro mesh on the gears. The vehicle was no doubt a leftover from World War II. Not long after the purchase, my mother suggested I learn to drive, as we were living alongside an active volcano that could blow at any time. Her plan was that in the event of an eruption, I could drive myself and anyone else to safety. For driving lessons, we needed a suitable place. We were told that the Rabaul airstrip was perfect, because, by late afternoon, most of the air traffic had come and gone, freeing up the airstrip for driving lessons. My mother would drive us out to the airstrip, after which we would ceremoniously change places. It was here I was introduced to the mysteries of double declutching, and I remember spending many happy hours practicing changing gear, making U-turns, and reverse parking between two large rocks. However, mastering hill starts came a little later. There were lots of other adventures too, but one in particular is a standout. In 1942, Rabaul was occupied by the Japanese, and for the remainder of World War II, the township became their major South Pacific supply base. To protect their base, Simpson Harbour was heavily fortified. Fast forward to 1960, and the area was still littered with reminders of the Japanese occupation. In 1963, we moved to a house on Namanula Hill, overlooking Simpson Harbor. Exploring the numerous Japanese gun emplacements, situated in the hills encircling the harbor, was for a time, an exciting after-school adventure. We left our bikes where the road ran out, and pushed on into the bush, in search of the remains of numerous anti-aircraft guns, some of which had been partially cleared of the encroaching bush. We were fascinated by the numerous tunnels that ran off the gun pits, and chose to ignore the post-war horror stories and warnings of unstable and booby-trapped tunnels. Occasionally, if we had a torch, we'd pluck up courage to explore one of them. The leader would shine the torch into the darkness, and we would follow, all the while keeping low, and resisting the urge to scream, as the bats we had disturbed streamed out over our heads. One afternoon, the novelty wore off in an instant, when part of a tunnel collapsed, and we had to dig ourselves out. This experience brought our Indiana Jones-style adventures to an immediate halt. We swore each other to secrecy, and to my knowledge, our parents never did find out. Through to the end of 1963, my unremarkable education continued at Rabaul High School. Jock Christian remained my significant other until I was sent south to boarding school in early 1964. This was a common experience for many expatriate teenagers. In the school changeover, I lost contact with Jock. Years later, I heard that he had gone on to study medicine at the University of Papua New Guinea, and later specialized in the treatment of tropical diseases. At a school reunion, some 40-plus years later, I met Jock and his wife of many years. We were gathered together on the Brisbane River, aboard the Kookaburra Queen. The draw card was the promise of the freshest seafood, plus plenty of grog, and of course, the company. Whilst we were indulging ourselves, I caught up with some of the people I had known at Rabaul High. After lunch, most of our group left the dining table and moved outside to take in the views of Brisbane City as the paddle steamer slowly chugged along, leaving Jock and I facing each other across the table. In the stilted chat that followed, he confessed I was the love of his life, concluding with,
"Look what you missed out on."
Me, a doctor's wife? The prospect filled me with dread. I was so shocked, I was rendered speechless, in part, because what I saw across the table had little appeal. Unable to speak, I missed the opportunity to point out that I didn't feel I had missed out on anything. But I digress. Our extraordinary four-year sojourn in tropical Rabaul ended whilst I was away at boarding school in Australia. My mother packed up our lives and moved to Kundiawa, in the Simbu province of the New Guinea Highlands, to take up a newly created position with the Department of Trade and Industry. Her new role was to introduce spinning and weaving skills into the highlands, thereby providing the local people with the opportunity to enter the cash economy. The wool project, as it was called, had the potential to change the lives of all concerned. And it did. But I'm getting ahead of myself. On reflection. Rabaul. My years in Rabaul were both formative and informative. There, I had the privilege of being an uninvited guest in another's culture. I was fascinated by our hosts, the Tolai people, in particular, their customs, their language, and their food. I quickly learned to speak the lingua franca, Tok Pisin, and was often called upon to interpret for my mother when she got stuck. As a result, I began to shoulder more and more domestic responsibility as we adjusted to life in the tropics. A life that was in marked contrast to our former life, that of city dwellers from Australia. Firearms? I was thankful to learn how to fire a rifle. After Maxwell McLean had taught me gun safety, we occasionally practiced target shooting, and I recall being quite a good shot. Gun craft is a useful skill to have, but I've had no need to use a rifle since. Anglo teenagers in 1960s Rabaul. As white teenagers, we were quite safe as we pedaled all over town and wandered the surrounding bush. We were fearless teens, prepared to push our physical boundaries in search of adventure. In retrospect, we were extremely lucky not to have come to grief. Japanese anti-aircraft guns. After the war, the resourceful Tolai people systematically stripped the guns that surrounded Simpson Harbor of whatever metal pieces were small enough to be carried into a ball to sell for scrap metal. Jock Christian. As I've got older, I've come to realize that, for both men and women, the intensity of first love often lingers. Facts. Simpson Harbor is considered one of the best natural harbors in the South Pacific. The Japanese occupation of Rabaul. The Japanese occupied Rabaul from the 23rd of February, 1942, until the 2nd of September 1945, when the war in the Pacific ended. Slave labor. The Japanese used a slave labor force in Rabaul that was made up of local people, as well as Australian, British, Chinese, Indian, Indonesian and Korean prisoners, many of whom were captured at Singapore. These people were forced to dig between 300 and 500 kilometers of tunnels into the volcanic soil around Simpson Harbor to accommodate the military garrison. The garrison consisted of barracks, air raid shelters, storehouses, accommodation, offices, command centers, and an underground hospital complex for up to 100,000 soldiers, as well as thousands of support personnel, including sex slaves known as comfort women. Barge tunnels. Along the shoreline of Simpson Harbor on the Kokopo Road, tunnels were dug to conceal boats and barges, thereby protecting them from frequent Allied bombing raids. After the raids, the barges were returned to the harbor, and garrison life continued. Many of these tunnels survive and are a lasting reminder of the Japanese presence.